Boarding an airplane always involves seatmate roulette. You never know who you'll end up next to, the parents with the cranky baby, the kid with the blasting headphones, or perhaps the most likely candidate, the chatterbox. And for therapists, the seemingly innocuous opening line, "So what do you do for a living?" can hold special dread. Pity the traveling mental health professional, wrote Liz Galst in a recent piece in the New York Times. And this can be a problem for other professions as well. Doctors, lawyers, talk show hosts. How do you answer the question, what do you do, and what happens after you answer it? Tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Liz Galst is a freelance journalist, frequently writes for the New York Times, Salon.com, and Mother Jones, among others, and joins us today from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And you talked to a lot of different therapists for this story and found that most of them say seatmates fall into two broad groups.
Yes. They either are frightened that they're going to be analyzed by their therapist seatmate and they completely clam up, or they see it as a free session and are want to talk from beginning to end.
And want to talk from beginning to end, a free therapy session. This is, you know, if you're flying to Sydney, this is going to be a long flight.
Yeah. In fact, The longer the flight, the worse it often is for the mental health professional.
And there's, I guess, two schools of thought amongst them as to whether you engage these people or not.
Right. There are some people who really value the human interaction and feel like even though they're off duty, that there's something that they can gain from it and they can actually be helpful to the people who they're talking to. And then there are other people who sort of filter the information that they provide about their work. They might say something that's true about their work, but that it nevertheless doesn't reveal that they're a mental health professional. I interviewed one practicing adolescent psychologist, a psychiatrist and sociologist at the University of Chicago, a man named Narjan Karanik, and he says to people, "I'm a sociologist," and he said, "That's an effective conversation ender."
And indeed, he is a sociologist, but he's also does other things as well.
Right.
And are people interested in talking about their own problems or, you know, I have a friend?
Well, you know I have a friend is an easy entree into discussing your own problems, but there are plenty of people who kind of barge right in. One woman I interviewed who's a child psychologist in San Francisco sat down next to a man on a plane, and he started telling her about the affair he was having and how he wanted to leave his wife, but he had business interests to protect. That went on and on. She was unable to get him to stop, and finally she interrupted and said, "Look, I'm going to listen to my iPod for a little bit." She put in her earbuds, and 5 minutes later, he pulled them out again and started in again on his issues. So it's really a struggle for them.
He pulled out her earbuds?
Yeah, he pulled out her earbuds.
Isn't that a little rude?
Yeah.
I would think so. That would fall into the rude category.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we're going to hear from people who've been in that situation, whether you're a mental health professional or some of the other people who find it difficult sometimes to engage your seatmate with your real profession. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. William's on the line from Cincinnati.
Thanks so much. I'm a child psychologist in Cincinnati, and it frequently happens if someone asks, "What do you do for a living?" and you say you're a child psychologist, it's like, "Oh, my son does this or my granddaughter does that." I've recently started saying, "I work for the IRS," and then people become very quiet very quickly.
That's a conversation killer. What do you tell your child patients about lying?
Well, I deal a lot with the IRS. I'm not, you know, I don't necessarily work for them. I pay them, but I don't necessarily work for them.
So it's by extension, perhaps you could make this argument, I suppose. All right. Dissembling, perhaps
exactly.
Better than lying. William, thanks very much for the phone call.
Yeah. In fact, the sociologist at the University of Chicago said he felt like he told the truth rather than just simply lying, because he relied on his patients to come into his office and tell them the truth about their lives, and that they couldn't do effective interventions and therapy if they weren't honest. So it was important to him to be honest about his work. He just didn't reveal all of it.
This from Chris, who says, "I tell people I'm a computer programmer. Nobody asks more." Maybe he's just not flying to Silicon Valley. Let's go next to Chris, and Chris is calling from Longmont in Colorado.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a professional skateboarder. I travel pretty much all the time. And you can usually sense right away what kind of person you're sitting next to. So if someone asks me what I'll do, to avoid the inevitable conversation. I just mason or carpenter, and they usually just kind of end the conversation right there.
Why do you not want to talk about skateboarding on the plane?
Well, because a lot of times, you know, you can, I know, it's hard to explain. You can just kind of sense the person that you're sitting next to. Sometimes I enjoy having that conversation and talking to people, but, you know, a lot of times you're just tired and you just get from point A to point B.
And so you just ask for a little privacy and try to find some profession that will be excruciatingly dull.
Yeah, well, not so much dull, not to, you know, put any of the professions down, but something that just, you know, won't ask you, in my opinion, silly questions.
When you do get involved and engaged in a conversation with somebody, what's the most interesting question you've ever been asked about being a pro skateboarder?
Injuries. How many injuries have I had? What kind of insurance plan do I have? How much money do I make? All that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah, well, that could get tiresome after a while, I suspect.
Unless it's a really pretty girl, of course.
Well, that's completely different. Yeah. Thanks very much for the call, Chris. Bye. This is obviously, you talk to mental health professionals, but this obviously does afflict other people, and I suspect it afflicts freelance writers, too. Do you get asked by people on planes what you do for a living?
You know, I try to take very few planes because I write a lot about environmental issues, and air travel has a huge environmental impact. But occasionally I do get asked, and people ask me what I write about, and sometimes I tell them that I write about business travel.
And
they come up with fantastic ideas.
You know, you really ought to look into blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I wrote recently an article that's going to appear in the Times on business travel fraud, people who overbill their expense accounts. And it's turned out to be a fascinating topic. So that was a suggestion I got while I was traveling.
Let's go next to Sam. Sam with us from New York.
Hello. Yes. My story is kind of fun. I was on a television series called Providence on NBC, and I was going over my lines for my job. And this guy, he was sort of loquacious. He was talking to me, sort of nice. And he started asking me if I wanted help with my lines. And I sort of was like, no, thank you. You're like, how are you going to help me? You know, because it's a little skill to be able to act and stuff. And lo and behold, it ended up being Jeff Franklin, who's a producer. He's produced like a billion television series. And he ended up being a really cool cat, and it was really a fun journey, and I was happy that I did let him help me with my lines.
And has he called back to hire you at any subsequent date?
I didn't end up working with him, but I did end up going to a couple of fantastic house parties in L.A.
Well, see, it wasn't a complete waste of time then.
Not at all.
Oh, sick. Okay, Sam. Thanks very much. And that's a little like your story, Liz Galst, about the, you know, getting tips on business trip fraud.
Yeah, I think you can learn a lot from your seatmates oftentimes. I've heard fascinating stories about people's work, people's lives. I think there's a lot to be gleaned, but there are times when you just want to read the Inflame magazine.
Let's go to Adrienne, and Adrienne's with us from Santa Rosa, California.
Yes, hi. I'm a registered nurse, and I've been called forward to help assess a person on a plane at least four times, and every time it turned out to be kind of a mental health anxiety issue. I even sat in the cockpit on a flight coming back from Mexico pre-2011 just to help assess with the pilot and a ground person who was a medical doctor someplace in Texas, I think, whether the patient was having a heart attack or having an anxiety reaction.
So your professional skill was called upon?
Yes. But then I had to sit the whole rest of the plane ride with all of these different people just to kind of keep them comfortable for the rest of the flight, which was sometimes as much as 6 or 7 more hours.
And did you wish you had a little taxi meter? You could just drop the flag?
Yeah, I wish that the airline was more generous in their turning me onto maybe a $50 coupon for a seat flight or something.
Oh, and how did they find out you were a registered nurse?
They asked people if there was anybody on board who had any medical knowledge, and I happened to be one of the people on board.
That's very interesting. But, of course, once you respond to a crisis, you feel like you have to respond to a crisis. You can't just pretend at that point you're a librarian.
Exactly. Well, yeah, and it's just my nature to want to help people out. And these people are all very nice people. They just were in the middle of having, you know, difficult problems in their lives.
Well, thanks very much for the call. And we'll be glad to fly with you anytime.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. There were several psychologists, or at least one in your piece, Liz Galst, who said they, you know, end up talking to people who have fear of flying.
Yeah. I interviewed a man named Dr. Simon Rigo, who's a cognitive and behavioral therapist. That's a kind of a therapy that's been very effective in dealing with anxiety disorders. All the clinical research shows it's at least as effective as medication. And he happened one day to sit next to a woman who had an extreme fear of flying and wanted treatment on the spot. So I think, you know, he said that he often uses techniques from his therapy to help intervene in these situations where the person next to him won't stop talking.
Using his professional skill to, in
yes.
other words, maneuver around it. There are also, in your piece, some legal questions that people had about this.
Well, a lot of the mental health professionals are quite worried about being sued for professional misconduct. And I spoke to a Georgetown law professor, a man named M. Greg Block, who is both a trained psychiatrist and a law professor. And he says that there's absolutely no risk of liability for breach of professional conduct or other professional reasons. But nevertheless, the American Psychological Association and other professional groups warn their members to be extremely careful to express that this, whatever they're saying, is not in the context of professional treatment, of medical treatment. Often some of the mental health professionals said to me they made a point of pointing out to whoever they were sitting with that this was whatever they might be saying, anything that might be construed as advice was just one person talking to another and not professional advice.
And I may be a psychologist, but I'm not your psychologist.
That was my favorite line in the entire piece. Yes, the woman who had her earbuds pulled out is now armed with a bunch of phrases that she has read at her ready for people who are sort of breaching the social conventions. And she says to them, I may be a psychologist, but I'm not your psychologist.
We're talking with freelance journalist Liz Galst about her piece that appeared in the New York Times, Cornered Therapists on Planes. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to AJ. AJ with us from Lehigh Acres in Florida.
Hello.
You're on the phone. You're on the line, AJ. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a pastor, and certainly I can empathize with the idea that there are moments where certainly you always look for opportunities to be able to do your job and to do it well, but there are times when I have definitely wanted to put in the metaphoric earplug, and a lot of times those opportunities don't present themselves because people do find out what you do. And one of the most interesting things that I have happened is if someone's talking to me and they happen to be talking about something that's very off color, using colorful language, and I sit there and I say a small prayer to myself that they don't end up going to a conversation on vocation, because inevitably what ends up happening is they become very embarrassed, no matter how much I assure them that it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. There's something, Liz Galst, you wrote about this, that this sense of intimacy, the shared intimacy, where there's you know, people unburden themselves in these circumstances a great deal more than they might in others.
Right. They're in a confined space. They're all headed towards the same destination. And there's an artificial sense of intimacy that gets created. And I think especially with people who are in the helping professions like clergy people and also mental health professionals, people want to be validated for the choices that they've made in their lives. I interviewed a psychiatrist in Rhode Island who's written two books about marriage. And he said he often hears from people who were divorced, who explain why their marriage couldn't work out, and they want to sort of prove that they made the right choices, and they want to be validated in those choices.
They want them to say at the end, "Well, you are absolutely right. In
you
fact, you should have held out
right.
for more."
That alimony settlement was terrible.
Terrible. Here's my card. Yes, right. AJ, thanks very much for the call. This from Michael in Minneapolis. It seems that asking what do you do for a living is a purely American habit. I've always found it rude and intrusive. I think we should try to discourage the question. I've taken to saying, I get by. So that might discourage people. Linda's on the line. Linda calling from St. Louis.
Hi. I work in the field of forensics, a criminalist, like in the series CSI.
Uh-huh.
Well, I got to tell you, I feel like I'm always living in the center of a TV show or a movie.
So you can't put crime scene tape around your seat and pretend that nobody can get through.
Exactly, and I have not quite figured out what to tell people that I do for a living besides what I do. So it is very uncomfortable. I get put on the spot anywhere from, oh, what car do you drive? Oh, and can you look at my my brother's crime? Can you tell me about this? All the way to legal advice, which I'm certainly not qualified to give. So
well, one of my One of my interview subjects suggested that he might say he was a spy, which would be a real conversation ender.
I'm not sure. I'd have lots of questions for spy.
Yeah, but then they would have an excuse for not answering them.
Oh, I see.
It's all hush-hush.
Hush-hush, undercover.
I may have to try that one.
An undercover CSI.
And that's undercover CSI. That's exactly right.
Linda, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's see if we go next to Eric. And Eric's with us from Charlotte.
Hi, Neil. How you doing? I'm a clown.
And I take it you don't wear your red nose on the plane.
No, but, you know, there is a society of us called the Red Toe Society where we paint one of our toes red so that we always have our red nose with us.
I see. And do people ask you about what you do for a living on the plane?
They do. And every single time someone asks, they never believe I speak English because they always say, what? And I say, I'm a clown again. And the next thing they say is, I don't believe you. And I say, no, really. And then, you must love kids. It's a succession. Every single time the conversation starts, all three of those questions come out in that order.
Exactly in that order. And of course, I suspect you do like kids.
Well, our kids aren't so bad. Mine are really great. You know. The thing is, as far as entertaining kids go, I love entertaining kids. I tried being a stand-up comedian and being a movie actor and stuff, and I just wasn't getting the niche. And then about 20 years ago, I went to Clown College with Ringling Brothers, and I found out that there's my audience right there. They're all under the age of 11.
Eric, thanks very much for the call, and good luck with that.
You bet.
And here's an email we got from Lynn. I once sat next to a mental health professional, a neuropsychologist, on a plane, and that was the beginning of an 8-year love affair that was one of the happiest times of both of our lives. So this can work out for people. Liz Galst, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Liz Galst is a freelance journalist. Her recent piece in the New York Times cornered therapists on planes. There's a link to it at our website at npr.org. Tomorrow, Jennifer Ludden will guest host with a look at the problems and solutions of aging in prison. This is NPR News.